of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This is Karen Edwards reading for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Modern Maturity. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the AARP magazine. And I'm going to start with an article on Alan Alda. Alan Alda is obsessed with the power of science. Some 40 years after MASH ended, the beloved actor and advocate remains passionate about laughter, respect, and the facts. Alan Alda isn't letting social distancing keep him from the people he loves. Soon after Alda, 84, and Arlene, 87, his wife of 63 years, quarantined themselves at their home on Long Island, they began holding video chats with friends and family via Zoom, the popular video conferencing app. "The other night we had dinner, virtually, with three couples," said Alda, who, using Zoom's virtual background feature, put up a gorgeous travel video of Italy during cocktails. "I'm a little bit ahead of most of my friends digitally. For years, I've been fixing their computers, and I call my service Celebrity Tech Support. The slogan is, why let a nobody touch your stuff?" Alda lands the joke with that winning ear-to-ear grin. "I can tell because we're Zooming too. His presence, as reassuring on my laptop screen as it was all those years ago on the beloved TV war comedy MASH, his iconic surgeon character Benjamin Franklin Hawkeye Pierce brought intelligence, wit, and sanity to a world of chaos, much as Alda is doing himself right now. In nearly four decades since MASH signed off, with what remains the most watched episode in television history, the six-time Emmy recipient has focused on something way broader than show business. He wants us all to relate and communicate better. His podcast, Clear Plus Vivid with Alan Alda, which launched in 2018, features such megawatt guests as Tom Hanks and Paul McCartney, hinges on communication. It's just two people really listening to each other for 45 minutes, he said. If one subject stands out in these heart-to-hearts, it's science. For 11 years, Alda, who describes himself as a walking question mark, was the engaging host of Scientific American Frontiers, a PBS show in which he got brainy engineers, medical researchers, and Nobel laureates to talk more like the rest of us. He turned the gig into a full-time mission. In 2009, he established the Alden Alda Center for Communicating Science at Stony Brook University on Long Island, where he loosens up scientists using improvisational techniques he learned during 50 years of acting. Some 15,000 participants have come through his communication training so they can better share their critical work with clarity and passion. "People are dying because we can't communicate in ways that allow us to understand one another," he explained in his 2017 book, If I Understood You, Would I Have This Look on My Face? That sounds like an exaggeration, but I don't think it is. When patients can't relate to their doctors and don't follow their orders, when engineers can't convince a town that the dam could break, when a parent can't win the trust of a child to warn her off a lethal drug, they can all be headed for a serious ending. Communicating science matters more than ever to Alda these days. Not only is he in the age group most at risk for COVID-19, he's also battling Parkinson's disease, another illness with no cure. He doesn't let that get him down. If anything, he finds inspiration in mysteries yet to be unraveled. "We don't value our ignorance enough," he notes in a candid, wide-ranging, and frequently hilarious conversation. "Ignorance is really good to have if it's combined with curiosity, and scientists are professional curiosity machines. We should all imitate that as much as possible. Now it's clear that our lives depend on it." "I'm having a good time under the circumstances," he said. in answer to the question, what has life been like for you since the outbreak of the coronavirus pandemic? The other day, we were walking 6 feet apart with friends in a secluded area, and I said, what's the best thing that happened since this began? One friend looked at me with a kind of stupefied expression, like, what do you mean, best? What's good? But I've found a lot of positive things. I'm very happy about some of the changes we've had to go through. For one thing, my wife Arlene, the author of 19 books, is looking for ways to be creative during this time. So she's gone back to painting and drawing, and she plays the piano every day, and she's experimenting with cooking. She looks into a sometimes empty refrigerator and comes up with a delicious meal. I haven't eaten this well since the last pandemic. Question, you've been advocating for years for better communication around science. Are we finally getting the message as a society? His answer, one of the most basic things I've tried to do is give people a greater understanding of how science works, the importance of evidence, the importance of many trials, of rigorous studies, and the idea that we learn only a little bit at a time. No single study is the end-all answer for everything. Making people aware of that process helps increase appreciation and respect for science, and that helps us make informed decisions for our families and ourselves. Unfortunately, I probably need another 25 years to help the culture achieve trust in science overall, because there are pockets of people who still think science is just another opinion. That mindset puts us all in danger, because it can affect people across the country. So I'm very concerned about the casual attitude many people have toward science. There are bright spots, I think. Infectious diseases expert Anthony Fauci is doing a wonderful job. He's straddling two worlds, science and belief. It's like that silent movie shot where someone's balanced on top of two moving trucks that are getting further and further apart. His legs are stretching as far as they can. But Fauci, who was on my podcast in March, comes closest to being the national figure most trusted by the rest of the country. With information changing so quickly, it's hard to know what to believe. His answer, well, you have to check the source. There's a lot of fake information out there. Gargle with this. Hold your breath for 10 seconds. If the only source is my cousin who knows somebody in the field, in the healthcare field, that's not a reliable source and can do more harm than good. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention or the World Health Organization, those are the best sources, and you've got to go straight to their websites to see what they have to say. I also cross-check information at fact-checking website Snopes.com. That's S-N-O-P-E-S, as often as I can. But beyond that, in a fundamental way, there's a problem we have now that we haven't had before, which is that we're operating with our own circles of kinship and friendship and information. Moderator, any advice on getting out of our own little bubble? His answer, the scientists I've interviewed tell me it's a good idea to spread the information you know to be correct with those outside your circle. If there's anybody you know whom you don't ordinarily communicate with and who has his or her own circle, try to include that person so we can extend our reach with real information and also with encouragement. Mental health is as important as physical health. They're intertwined. I'm talking like I'm an expert, but I've only been studying this for 25 years. You survived polio as a kid. What do you remember about that epidemic? I got it when I was 7. I had a stuffy nose at the Warner's movie theater, honking the whole evening. I couldn't clear my nose. When I got home, I threw up and my legs were unsteady. The next day, I had a stiff neck. I couldn't sit up in bed. My parents called the doctor, went to the hospital, had a spinal tap. I was in the hospital for 2 weeks. But then I had about 6 months of therapy devised by Elizabeth Kinney, the famous nurse from Australia. I had nearly scalding blankets wrapped around my limbs every hour. It was hard on me. It was harder, I think, on my parents, who couldn't afford a nurse and had to torture me themselves. It's always better to pay somebody to torture your kid. Moderator, it doesn't appear that Parkinson's disease has slowed you down much, if at all. How did you first discover you had it? His answer. In 2015, I read an article in the New York Times by Jane Brody, in which a couple of doctors said some of their Parkinson's patients had one particular early symptom, and it's an unusual one. People act out their dreams while they're asleep. I realized I had done just that. I had dreamed somebody was attacking me, and in the dream, I threw a sack of potatoes at him. In reality, I threw a pillow at my wife. So, believing there was a good chance I had Parkinson's, I went to a neurologist and asked for a brain scan. He examined me and said, "I don't think you need a scan. You don't have any symptoms." I said, "Well, I'd really like the scan anyway." And he called me back and said, "Boy, you really got it." "Wow, how did you react?" "I began to exercise. A lot of people hear they have Parkinson's and get depressed and panicky and don't do anything, just hoping it'll go away. It's not going to, but you can hold off the worst symptoms. Movement helps. Walking, biking, treadmills." And I'll add dancing to that. "But also specific things. I move to music a lot. I take boxing lessons from a guy trained in Parkinson's therapy. I do a full workout specifically designed for this disease. It's not the end of the world when you get this diagnosis." You've incorporated Parkinson's into roles in the film Marriage Story and on TV's Ray Donovan. That character's tremor was more advanced than yours, right? "Whenever they did close-ups of my hand, I was supposed to be shaking a bit, so I had to fake it. My hand didn't shake that much. Now I could give them a good shake." It's been almost 40 years since MASH ended. Do you think a carousing womanizer like Hawkeye Pierce could survive on TV in today's hashtag MeToo era? Even in that era, I was, as you probably know, a very outspoken feminist, and I wasn't just talking about it. I was trying in every way to work from that point of view in my life. We had many discussions on MASH, even before we started shooting, to help shift the vision of the character from the male schoolboy approach. I was able to win a lot of those discussions, but some I didn't, and I'm very sorry that I didn't. That character was a product of the time and accepted by the culture, especially by men, not so much by women. Thank goodness, it's hard to make a case now for that kind of insulting behavior. It's not acceptable ipso facto, and that's progress. Question, you and Arlene got married 63 years ago. What's your secret? His answer. Arlene's answer is that the secret to a long marriage is a short memory. My answer? Love. Even when you're yelling at the person, and there will be yelling, keep in mind that this is the person you love more than anything. That changes your tone, so you don't say, "I hate you." You say, "I hate you." You have 3 children and 7 grandchildren. Are you optimistic about their future? With the world changing so rapidly, there's no point in being optimistic or pessimistic about anything. You've just got to surf uncertainty because it's all we get. A question I ask around the dinner table with friends is, how long do you think our species will last? Scientists tell me the average species, when you factor in dinosaurs and fruit flies and everything, lasts about 2 million years. So my question is, do you think we'll be lucky enough to be average? If we're not careful, we can kill each other off. And if we're not smart enough to take care of what nature has in store for us, who knows how long we'll last? And finally, so what's the best thing for humans to do? Laugh. Laughter is good. That's one of the greatest benefits of this isolation. My wife and I are laughing more than we ever have. When you laugh, you're vulnerable. You're opening yourself up. You're not protected. That's why a lot of executives don't laugh much, because they think it gives up their strength. But you gain so much through vulnerability. You let the other person in, and that brings us all closer. We can't take ourselves too seriously, even now. A good friend emailed recently and said, "Alan, how are you doing? How is everything?" I wrote back and said, "I'm still alive. If that changes, I'll let you know." Now I'm going to give you a few thoughts from Nicole Mahabir of CBC Life in Canada. And we won't have time for all of these, but I'll read some of them from time to time. Self-soothing strategies to help break a chain of anxious thoughts quickly. These experts share techniques that might work for you on the spot. It's an unprecedented time in our lives, and many of us are dealing with feelings of great uncertainty about our individual futures and the future of our world. We're learning to adjust to new schedules and seeking ways to handle a deluge of new information and cope with life changes. Anxiousness may arise as a normal reaction to this, and when our challenges feel overwhelming, chains of anxious thoughts can lead us to hopeless feelings and negative feelings. Anxiety can also manifest in the body. To help address anxiety when it arises, we invited two experts, Dr. Anna Bodnar, a registered clinical psychologist and yoga and meditation teacher, and Pradeep Kumar, a former physician who teaches integrative mind and body medicine and meditation courses, to share simple and effective practices that can neutralize anxiousness and soothe the moment. Thought interruption practices. Rumination in the form of repetitive thoughts is often aligned with anxiety, said Bodnar. Anxiety has a cyclical pattern that, if not interrupted, will run its course. Here are some techniques to interrupt anxious thoughts. Positive self-talk. Bodnar describes positive self-talk as an intervention that can bring the mind back to reality in a safe and caring way. A simple way to reduce anxiety is to use your internal voice to address what is happening and to acknowledge that there is an end within reach, she says. Kumar says that we can even interrupt anxious thought patterns while we stay present in a conversation. Self-talk breaks the anxiety cycle and helps you to release the rumination of the thoughts you are holding on to, allowing you to stay present and focused. Bodnar suggests reciting these positive phrases. Even if I am feeling anxious right now, it will pass. Even if this feels uncomfortable right now, it will come to an end soon. I can cope. I have been through difficult situations before. I am more than my anxiety. It is a state that will pass. If an experience starts to become overwhelming, it could also be appropriate to remove yourself from the situation, if possible, until you can bring yourself back into a state of comfort and ease. It's also important to recognize that anxiety is different from having a panic attack. A panic attack can be an intense experience that may require counsel for appropriate care and treatment, Bodnar says. I'm not going to continue with this article right now, but I will come back to it from time to time. Now let's look at another article from the AARP magazine, Where We Stand, Women and Dementia. AARP is encouraging people to focus on brain health. As our population ages, the number of people living with dementia is projected to increase dramatically. Today, more than 6 million people in the United States have some kind of dementia, including Alzheimer's disease, and those numbers are growing at an alarming rate around the world. This takes a devastating toll, not only on those who are suffering, but also on their caregivers. Women are at the center of this crisis. Why? Because 2/3 of Americans with Alzheimer's are women, and more than 60% of Alzheimer's and dementia caregivers are women. The economic burden of dementia on women in the U.S. is estimated to be $91.1 billion. I believe AARP can play a key role in helping solve these challenges. That's why I was excited last year to join the Brain Trust, which is chaired by former First Lady Laura Bush. The trust, established for women by the group Us Against Alzheimer's, is dedicated to transforming how women see, think, and talk about brain health. This month, AARP, along with the Milken Institute's Center for the Future of Aging and Us Against Alzheimer's, will convene a meeting of the Brain Health Partnership that will focus on prevention, including steps women can take to help keep their minds sharp and reduce their risk of cognitive decline. And in May, AARP will release a report with Maria Shriver's Women's Alzheimer's Movement that is called It's Time to Act, The Challenges of Alzheimer's and Dementia for Women. This report reflects the views of science and policy thought leaders on how to address the women's Alzheimer's crisis. Following the report's release, we will launch an effort to engage women directly. The campaign will encourage women to take the Be Brain Powerful 30-Day Challenge. Each day, participants will receive an email with suggestions for themselves and their families. We hope you will join us and challenge yourself at stayingsharp.org. AARP is in this for the long term. We have implemented a three-part strategy focused on prevention, care, and cure. Our goals are to reduce risks for cognitive decline, to create opportunities for people living with dementia and their caregivers, and to spark hope for the future by investing to help find a cure. We convene the Global Council on Brain Health to bring together scientists, doctors, scholars, and policy experts around the world to debate the latest in brain health science. The goal is to reach consensus about what therapies work and to translate critical scientific information on brain health into simple actions people can take every day to help them stay sharp throughout their lives. We have also invested $60 million in the Dementia Discovery Fund to pay for research and development aimed at creating cutting-edge treatments and ultimately a cure for Alzheimer's and other types of dementia. And our Staying Sharp digital platform has tons of advice to help people protect and strengthen their brains. At AARP, we recognize that we can't simply sit back and wait for a cure. We need to work to reduce risk, improve care, and help people keep their brains healthy while they age. Many experts believe that up to one-third of dementias can be prevented or delayed by modifying behavioral risk factors. They estimate that if we can stall the onset of dementia by just 5 years, we can cut the incidence rate in half. Pledge to do your part to be brain healthy. The stakes are high, especially for women who bear the heaviest burden when dementia strikes. And there again, that website is Staying Sharp, capital STAYING, capital SHARP dot org. Now we have a couple of little short items. When should we tell our kids about our end-of-life plans? Ask the expert. My spouse and I are preparing our advanced medical directives so our kids don't have to make decisions for us. One of the questions is whether we would like palliative care or hospice care. What's the difference? Both stress comfort and quality of life in managing life-threatening illness. The difference is that you can get palliative care while you're still pursuing treatment. Hospice is a type of palliative care, usually for those with life expectancy of 6 months or less. Private insurance, Medicare, and Medicaid may cover hospice. Be sure to discuss your wishes with your family, as well as putting them in writing. And that answer was from Carol Levine, author of AARP's Navigating Your Later Years for Dummies. Next question. At 70, I feel sharp, but dementia runs in my family. Do I get a DNA test to learn my risk? The Alzheimer's genes tests are controversial. Although a certain set of genes may raise the risk for Alzheimer's, they are not necessarily deterministic. That is, having them doesn't translate to a diagnosis. If you choose to get the test, do so under the guidance of a physician and genetic counselor. And remember, for many people, lifestyle habits, diet, exercise, sleep, learning, and social connections may be as important as genetics. And that answer was from Sanjay Gupta, CNN chief medical correspondent and author of Keep Sharp, Build a Better Brain at Any Age. And now to finish up today, I won't be able to read all of this article, but we'll read bits and pieces. We're on the way to a sustainable, resilient planet. 50 years after he was picked by Wisconsin Senator Gaylord Nelson to hastily organize the first Earth Day at the age of 25, Dennis Hayes thinks green is winning. You and your team inspired 20 million Americans to take part in the first Earth Day on April 22, 1970. How did you pull it off? We persuaded reporters to write about it and put our mailing address into articles. A week later, a flood of mail would come in. When we wanted to communicate, we would mimeograph 50,000 copies, stamp them, and send them out. Slow, but it worked. And the idea really struck a chord. The response was remarkable. There was dissatisfaction with the way the nation was developing. You couldn't see more than two blocks in some cities because of the air pollution. Places we used to swim and fish had no swimming and no fishing signs due to water pollution. Rivers were on fire. Breathing the air in places like Los Angeles was like smoking two or three packs of cigarettes a day. People began to think, there's something wrong. What's your most amazing memory of that day? Climbing up on a platform 60 or 70 feet in the air in New York City and speaking to a crowd that was like the sea stretching out ahead of you. It swelled on forever. That was the first time I had the sense that this was something enormous. How were you picked to head the effort? I flew to Washington, D.C. to meet with Earth Day founder Senator Gaylord Nelson, hoping that he didn't have an organizer lined up for Harvard. A couple of days later, his chief of staff asked me to drop out of school, move to D.C., and organize the entire U.S. What's the legacy of Earth Day? Legislation that was unthinkable in 1969 became unstoppable in the 70s. A tsunami of legislation emerged. Between 1970 and 76, the Clean Air Amendments of 1970, Clean Water Act, Endangered Species Act, Safe Driving Water Act, or Safe Drinking Water Act, and more were passed. Human health has improved dramatically. Well, folks, we've run out of time for today's episode of Modern Maturity. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Modern Maturity is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again, 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.